Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. This past Thanksgiving, President Obama set aside his agenda on immigration to take part in an annual holiday tradition.
To spare the lives of two turkeys, Mac and Cheese, from a terrible and delicious fate.
It should come as no surprise that the president's daughters, Malia and Sasha, who are there with their dad, found this whole charade just as cheesy as the rest of us. And yet after the event, they were critiqued by some as looking like bored, disinterested teenagers. One particularly nasty Facebook comment went viral, and the internet hasn't been able to stop talking about it since. Now, anybody who remembers the exploits of the Bush twins less than a decade ago knows that gossiping about presidential progeny is nothing new. But as it turns out, the practice is as old as the White House. Jamie Fuller writes about politics for The Washington Post, where you'll find her article, The Long and Fraught History of Judging the President's Kids. And Jamie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, great to be on.
So you combed through the archives sort of looking for historic examples of presidential kids in the news. What was the earliest case you were able to find?
Well, in fact, there are many people who would argue that the Lincoln boys were the worst presidential kids of all. People who went to the White House were always terrified that they'd have to deal with these kids who would play pranks on everyone. And you can find lots of instances of people writing in their diaries when they got home, like, it was great meeting the president, but those kids, they get away with everything.
And in fact, you have a bit of news clip here. It has somebody quoted as saying, had they expletive deleted in Lincoln's hat and rubbed it on his boots, he would have laughed and thought it was smart.
Yes. So I think the bar is pretty high for being a bad presidential kid.
Well, and it sounds like expectations were really different back then. So, you know, obviously this was long before TV, but do you think the political culture regarding the president's families was different too?
Oh, definitely. And you have the same thing with James Garfield, too. His kids were called Holy Terrors, and you can kind of sense the amusement that the country had about it. And there was very much, it felt kind of like a royal sense where people kind of loved the family and enjoyed watching them like their own. And now there's so much media that needs to be fed into all the time. It's kind of, there's a frustration that we don't hear much about the presidential kids. At the same time, the presidential families are being far more private with their kids, knowing that the media that they're going to have to deal with is far more than the Lincolns would have had to deal with.
Well, yeah, and I think one of the reasons the internet so vigorously defended the Obama girls is that, you know, these are people that aren't seeking the limelight. They don't have a choice about whether or not to be members of the first family. But you did write about one presidential daughter in your article who actually loved that sort of attention, Alice Roosevelt. What was her story?
She was a character, and people have been writing about her for so long because she did amazingly interesting things. And she was Teddy Roosevelt's child by his first wife, who died. And she always felt kind of apart from the rest of the family. And the way she dealt with that is by doing lots of pranks and kind of messing around. And she would always carry a snake around with her to parties, and the newspapers would cover it in like humongous headlines like, oh my goodness, there's a snake at the White House. And when McKinley died, she said that she experienced sheer rapture when it happened, which you can't even imagine anyone saying in those circumstances today. And she was just known as kind of the party child.
I can't imagine what that tweet would look like and how that would go over.
Yeah, no, exactly. And nowadays, before Malia and Sasha, you've, Teddy Roosevelt kind of was like, whatever. Like, he was kind of frustrated that his daughter was going to overshadow him on the front of the newspaper with her antics when he was doing important things, too. But he would never kind of shush the press in the way that the Clintons and the Bushes and the Obamas have.
Well, yeah, I grew up during the Clinton era, and I always had this sense that, regardless of whether or not the press always followed it, that the president's daughter, that Chelsea, was off limits. So when did that become a thing?
If you pay attention, you can kind of feel it happening with the start of the 24-hour news cycle. And when CNN became a thing, that was kind of when the president kind of shoved his family back into the house. And one thing you'll have with Chelsea Clinton is she was far younger than a lot of other presidential children who had been in the White House. And you see the same thing happening with Malia and Sasha, where they're so young that that's part of the protectiveness, even on top of the news cycle.
It's funny, when I was reading through your article, I realized that there's a difference, too, in how the president and the family has reacted. So when People magazine featured Chelsea in 99 on their cover, the Clintons put out just a very stiff statement, sort of denouncing the decision, saying it was a regretful move on people's part. But in 1950, President Truman had a very different reaction to criticism of his daughter, Margaret. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, no. Margaret was trying to become a famous singer, and she would often perform in places that you could never imagine performing at that age unless your father happened to be the president. And a Washington Post critic kind of slammed her performance and saying she had a long way to go, and just went on and on and on with the criticism. And when Truman saw that, he wrote a letter to the critic saying, like, threatening him and saying, "You better watch out. I'm coming for you if you do this again."
Yeah, he threatened to beat him up.
Yes. And you can't imagine anyone doing that today. And I think another reason that there's a new edge when people talk about presidential kids that wasn't there 50 or 100 years ago is there's a sense that the whole presidential family has become a partisan matter, in that people see the family as an extension of the president. And if they don't like the president, they see everything as fair game. And I don't think that was there in the same way 50 or 100 years ago.
Well, you're a political reporter. When do you think, if ever, a president's kids should be considered fair game for the media?
I think there's kind of been a sense honed in over the years that when there's governmental matters at stake, when there's legal issues at stake, you're welcome to talk about the presidential kids. And that's kind of why people talked about the Bush twins when they got in trouble in Texas over liquor laws. It's like, we're allowed to talk about this. Something's happened. But I think that's kind of been the rule that's set in, is when there's something else going on, like, write about it. But if it's personal issues, if it's anything small like that, stay back. And I'm sure it's going to keep changing as the media keeps ramping up. And so we'll see what happens. We'll see if it kind of extends into, at what point are we going to start talking about congressional kids too? Will we ever be at that point?
Oh, I don't know. There's just too many of them, though.
Exactly.
Jamie Fuller writes about politics for The Washington Post. You can read her article, "The Long and Fraught History of Judging the President's Kids," at wordofmouthradio.org. And Jamie, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Of course.
While some presidents were brought into the limelight because of the antics of their children, others have made a reputation for themselves through their very own bad behavior. Nate DeMayo of the Memory Palace brings us the sad story of one such president, near and dear to New Hampshire.
Franklin Pierce was the Mac. He was handsome, he was rich, he was connected. His dad was the governor of New Hampshire. He's in the state legislature at 24, in Congress before he's 30. When he's there, he does Washington up, early 19th century style, going to all the right parties, flirting chastely with senators' daughters, debating Aeschylus or the Magna Carta or whatever until dawn, and drinking all the time. All the time. He gets a reputation, and he starts to feel terribly about it, and just generally terrible. He's a loud drunk. He's always hungover. He tells a friend he needs to stop, straighten up his act. The friend sets him up with a woman named Jane Appleton, a minister's daughter. She's shy and frail and devout, and Franklin figures that she's just the kind of person he needs to save him from himself. Jane hates D.C. She hates the parties. She doesn't trust her husband's friends, his old drinking buddies. She keeps telling him to quit politics. He's a senator by now. Move away from this awful place and its bad influences and its booze. And he does. And they head back to New Hampshire and focus on raising their sons. For a while. He goes off to the Mexican-American War. While Franklin's away, Jane gets depressed and throws herself into her Bible and the temperance movement. And while Franklin's away, he throws himself back into his drinking. He comes back home a war hero, at a time when that sort of thing gets a man nominated for president. Jane doesn't want any of it. She's convinced that if Franklin goes back to Washington, he'll spiral out of control. She starts having visions that tell her terrible things will happen to their family if he runs. They'd already lost two of their three sons to illness. Shouldn't tempt God. But he does. And he wins the election. And Jane is despondent. This is a bad idea. Right before the inauguration, Franklin and Jane and their 11-year-old son, Benny, take a train trip to attend a funeral of a friend. They get out at one of the stops to stretch their legs, and there's an accident. The train decouples, and one of the cars rolls away. Their son is crushed beneath it. Jane is convinced that Benny's death is a sign. God doesn't want her husband to be president. And right there on the train platform, she refuses to come to Washington with him. And she goes home. He leaves a few days later. He's inaugurated, alone. His last remaining son has just died. His wife is convinced that it's his fault. He's sad and alone. And without Jane to look out for him, he starts hanging out with the boys and drinking. All the time. Spiraling. It takes him 2 years to convince the First Lady to come down to Washington in a last-ditch effort to save him from himself. She spends the rest of his administration upstairs in the White House, alone in a room at the end of the hall, writing heartbreaking letters to her dead son. Soon after they return to New Hampshire, Jane Pierce dies of TB. Soon after that, Franklin Pierce dies of a corroded liver. Also, as a president, he totally sucked.
That story came to us from Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace. Coming up, from encrypted apps to password protection, we go to great lengths to protect ourselves from hackers. But is free wireless internet making it easier for them to get to our personal information? The frightening reality behind public Wi-Fi hotspots when word of mouth continues.